The Devil's Deal by Randall Fielding. Chapter 1. Everything Starts Somewhere. Everything starts somewhere. The first time I smoked pot, I hardly knew what I was doing. I was 11 years old at the time, and it was our babysitter, of all people, who gave it to me. My mum was out at some big dinner or something, and we knew that she wouldn't be home for hours and hours. At that time, Lucy, the babysitter, was only about 16 or 17 herself. She probably thought it would be amusing to get me high. "Hey, Danielle," she said, "you want to try something nice?" She lit up the fat, untidy-looking joint she'd been rolling so studiously and took a long drag. "Is that what I think it is?" I said, pretending to know more than I actually did. "I mean, what do you know when you're 11 years old?" We passed the joint back and forward between us. Lucy showed me how to smoke it, how to hold the smoke in my lungs as long as possible. After a few minutes, I felt dizzy, then happy and relaxed. We started laughing at silly things. Everything seemed funny. And that was the first time. I didn't attach a lot of importance to it afterwards, but I was glad I had done it. I was glad, not so much because of the experience itself, although that was nice, but because I felt that having had the experience somehow made me more mature. I mean, who wants to be a baby all their life? Not that I was some kind of problem kid. I certainly wasn't that. It's true that my parents were divorced, but that had happened years before, and I'd gotten used to living on my own with Mum. In fact, we got on really well together. The only fights I can remember having with her were about keeping my room tidy. Things like that. Or there was one occasion when I wanted to surprise her by doing the week's laundry all by myself and made everything pink. I was from what's usually called a good home, a privileged home. Mum was a successful lawyer and could afford to give me pretty much anything I wanted. I had horse riding lessons, ballet lessons, piano lessons, my own computer, my own room, the kind of things you tend to take for granted when you have them. Sometimes I was bored, I guess, but I wasn't unhappy. And I wasn't stupid either. I mean, for years I was always near the top of my class at school. So, if I wasn't unhappy and wasn't stupid, how did I become a junkie? I met someone, that's how. I met Greg. I was 14 and a half at the time and dating a boy in my class called Tommy Fowler. Tommy had a brother who was a couple of years older than him. And one evening that their parents were away someplace, Tommy's brother decided to have a party. Tommy invited me. When I arrived, the first thing I noticed was that all the other kids were older than us. They were all seniors in high school. Just being in their presence, I felt shy and awkward. The second thing I noticed was that Tommy had been drinking heavily before I arrived. In fact, he was so drunk he could hardly stand. We went into the main room, where the lights had been turned down and where the music was booming out of the stereo system, and started to dance. But after only a few seconds, Tommy looked at me with a horrified expression and said, "I think I'm going to be sick." With that, he rushed off into the back of the house somewhere. I didn't know it then, but I wasn't going to see him again for the rest of the evening. But after he had been gone for about 15 minutes, I started to get worried. I was sitting in the kitchen, wondering what to do, while trying hard to look unconcerned, when Greg came over. "Hi," he said. "You want some of this?" He held out the joint he was smoking. Greg was a really good-looking guy, tall, dark, well-built, everything. He was always smiling. I hadn't smoked since that night long before with Lucy, but I didn't want to look stupid. So I took a drag of the joint and handed it back to him. But whatever it contained was much, much stronger than I expected. I hardly had time to say thanks when my head started to spin. I suddenly felt very, very tired, exhausted. All I wanted to do was lie down somewhere and sleep. I started to yawn, Hey, I heard Greg saying. Are you kidding? Come on, wake up. It isn't bedtime yet. Here, take a couple of these. These will keep you awake. And he handed me a couple of white pills and a glass of water. What are they? I said. Don't ask, he replied. Just swallow them. Believe me, you won't be sorry. He was right. 5 minutes later, we were back in the main room with the others. I didn't feel tired anymore, or shy, or out of place. My head was full of colours and music. I didn't have a problem or an inhibition in the world. I was with Greg. He was smiling like crazy, and so was I. We were dancing like demons. Chapter 2. Chasing the Dragon. During the next year with Greg, I smoked, swallowed and sniffed everything he did. Pot, ecstasy, speed, acid, coke. It just got better and better. Whatever doesn't kill you, Greg would say, grinning from ear to ear, makes you stronger. There was a line we didn't cross, though. We never touched a needle. I mean, that's how you get AIDS, right? We both knew that. It reminds me now of that story about the guy who makes a deal with the devil. For a while, the guy can have everything he wants. Money, beautiful women, power. But in the end, he has to give the devil his soul, forever and ever. Even if you aren't religious, you wonder how anybody could be dumb enough to make a deal like that. You'd really have to be a loser. But for a short while, that was more or less the deal that Greg and I made. We got exactly what we wanted, but it was going to cost us everything we had. The thing is, you see, the devil isn't the fat little guy you imagine, with red horns and a long pointed tail. Probably he looks different to everyone. In our case, he was a pinch of light brown powder in a cellophane bag. He didn't look any more dangerous than brown sugar. Even so, I said, I don't want to do this, Greg. It scares me. I don't want to get hooked. It was mid-afternoon. We had skipped school and were sitting in the apartment of a black guy called Jerry the Goldsmith. They called him that because he had a lot of gold teeth. Surprisingly, even though his apartment was in a slum area, it was full of fancy things. Expensive leather furniture, a giant TV, an elaborate stereo system, speakers everywhere. You're not going to get hooked, baby, Jerry said, his voice deep and smooth and relaxing. Only stupid people get hooked. People with no willpower. Besides, it isn't habit-forming unless you inject it. If you just smoke it or sniff it up your nose, it can't do you any harm at all. And you'll never feel anything as good as this. Never. You smoke a little of this and you'll be high all day today and tomorrow too. Higher than you've ever been. Believe me, baby, compared to this, marijuana is kid stuff. The devil is a salesman and a liar. I looked at Greg, but he just shrugged and smiled, as if to say, what have we got to lose? I'll tell you what, Jerry continued. This time it's on the house. You try a little of this and make your mind up later. If you like it, come back any time and we'll do business. Hold on a second. He stood up and walked into the kitchen. When he returned, he placed a spoon on the table and a glass of water. He took a $5 bill out of his pocket and rolled it up to make a kind of straw. Then he opened the little bag and poured the brown powder into the spoon. He added a few drops of water. I watched as he held a cigarette lighter under the spoon until wisps of smoke began to rise. He handed the straw to Greg and said, go ahead, man. Suck in some happiness. Greg put the straw in his mouth and sucked in some of the smoke. A look of contentment crossed his face as he passed the straw to me. I hesitated. Come on, baby, Jerry said. Don't be uncool. Do you think people use this stuff because it makes them feel bad? Try it just this once. Go on now. I took the rolled up $5 bill and sucked smoke into my mouth. It had a nasty taste, but that didn't matter. Immediately, the same instant that I could taste the smoke, I felt a warm rush go through my whole body. I leaned forward and vomited, but I didn't care. Nothing mattered. I felt relaxed and confident. I was free. I felt as if I were floating. I had no worries, no pain, no sadness. Those things didn't exist in the world. There was no stress or tension, only relief. It was the best feeling I had ever had. I didn't need to ask Greg for his opinion. He was sitting there in front of me, gently rocking backwards and forwards, that big grin all over his face. Jerry was smiling too, although he hadn't sucked in any of the smoke himself. He said, "You know what they call that, Danielle? What you just did? They call it chasing the dragon. What do you think? Did you catch it?" His voice was like soft music. Oh, I want to do this again," I heard myself saying. "I want to do this again." Were we hooked at that stage? I don't know. Maybe we could have stopped. But the fact is, a few days later, we both wanted to go and see Jerry again. We both wanted to feel that way again. The only difference was that from now on, we were going to have to pay. Chapter 3. Basic Economics. It doesn't matter what you call it, smack, or H, or skag, or junk, or just plain heroin. Once you've had some, you want more. And before you know it, you're hooked. You don't just want more, you have to have more. You're a junkie, a slave, a zombie. Heroin controls your every waking moment. When most people think of junkies, they think of the pitiful characters you see in the parks or in the streets downtown. Dirty and diseased, nameless, faceless, hurrying along with their heads down as if they're going to miss the last train to somewhere important. Or of the junkies whose dead bodies, half eaten by rats, are found in old abandoned factories. Greg and I weren't exactly like that. As I said, we were from good families. So, at the beginning, it was easier for us to get money. The only thing is, once you're a junkie, you need a lot of money. And every day you need more than the day before. The second little cellophane bag cost us $20, which we could easily afford from our allowances. But even the second time, I didn't feel the same rush as the first time. Greg was the same. We started needing more and more of it to get high. Soon we needed two, then three bags to have the same effect as that first one. The dragon became harder and harder to catch. At the same time, we quickly progressed from getting high only at weekends, when we went to discos or parties with our friends, to getting high every chance we could. It seems unbelievable now, but at one point it was costing us $100 a day. I started stealing money from my mother's purse. I pawned clothes, jewellery, CDs, anything that could get a few dollars. Greg was doing the same. I stopped going to my piano and ballet lessons and pocketed the money instead. We skipped school more and more often. We stole things from cars, from shops. We borrowed money from everyone we knew until no one would lend us anything anymore. Then we went to see Jerry the goldsmith. When we couldn't get money any other way, we begged. "Sorry, guys," Jerry would say. "I'm a businessman, and I have a strict policy. Absolutely no credit to anybody. Cash only. You got that?" I remember the first time I experienced withdrawal symptoms. I was lying in bed, unable to sleep, when suddenly I started to feel sharp pains in my arms and legs. Then nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. It was like the worst flu I had ever had, multiplied by 100. I went to the bathroom and took some of my mum's sleeping tablets, but still I couldn't sleep. I thought I was going to die. The next morning, I saw that Greg was in the same condition as me. He looked terrible, with big black rings under his eyes, from not having slept. He was agitated, desperate, and we were unable to comfort each other, unable to relax, unable to stop moving about. "Jesus, Danielle," he said, "what are we going to do? We've got to get some money from somewhere. We have to do something. He was picking nervously at the skin of his face, as if worms were eating it. Oh, great idea, I said sarcastically. Maybe you could suggest something a little bit more specific? Well, he said, if the worst comes to the worst, I mean, if there's absolutely no other solution, you've always got something you can sell. What? I asked. What are you talking about? Well, he started again, you're a good-looking girl, and you look older than you are. You're well built for your age, and... He stopped. It took me a few moments to understand. You can't be serious, I said. Greg, tell me you aren't serious, please. But I knew he was. I knew he would have done anything for even one little bag. Okay, he said. Okay, I have another idea. I hope it's better than the last one, I said bitterly. That evening I told my mother. Mum, you've got to help me. I've been using heroin and I owe a dealer $500 and he's going to kill me if I don't pay. Mum stared at me in amazement. If she thought I was joking, she didn't think so for long, because as soon as I had said the words, I burst into a flood of hysterical tears. She put her arms around me. I'm not an addict, I sobbed. I only tried it a couple of times, but he knows where I live. He says he'll kill us both. Oh, Danielle, Danielle, she said, what have you done? Why didn't you come to me before? She didn't want to give me the money, of course. She wanted to go to the police, but I begged and cried and cried and begged, telling her that that would be the worst thing she could possibly do. In the end, just to calm me down, she agreed. First thing next day, Greg and I were knocking on Jerry's door. He opened it about 2 inches and said, "Show me what you've got for me." I showed him the money and he let us in. After we had done business, Jerry said, "Listen, guys, let me give you some advice. Smoking and sniffing this stuff is simply bad economics. You can get higher from injecting a single bag than from smoking 4 or 5 bags. Think about it." Really, it was just a matter of time. And, as Jerry would have said, of basic economics. We knew we had to make our supply last longer. So, just 4 months after our first experience with heroin, we crossed the invisible line and started shooting it into our veins. Chapter 4. It happens all the time. After that, my home life with Mum became more complicated. For one thing, she wanted to know who I was with all the time and what I was doing. So I had to lie to her. And I had to get friends to lie for me. Also, Mum now insisted on driving me to school in the morning. What she didn't know was that I only stayed there long enough to be marked present on the register. Then I'd catch a train back into the city to meet Greg. Usually we'd go to a seedy hotel on East Mooring Street near Jerry's place and get a room for the day. We weren't the only junkies doing that, so the guy at reception didn't ask any questions. He would take our money and give us the room key without even looking at us. As soon as we got into the room, we would shoot up. Then we'd just lie there on the bed, not doing anything, not talking, just feeling the relief of the drug in our bodies. That was our whole life, getting high, getting sick, getting more money to get high again. Sometimes I felt guilty. I didn't like deceiving my mother, or lying to her, or stealing from her, or manipulating her love. I thought, my God, what have I become? I've got to stop using this stuff. I've got to get clean. But at the same time, I'd be thinking, where's the next fix coming from? How am I going to get the money? One day, I met Greg at the hotel. He had just been to visit Jerry, who had sold him some really, really good stuff. When we got into the room, I told him, "Listen, Greg, I'm going to try and get off this stuff. I want to get clean. I want to get my life back." "Oh, yeah," he said, already tightening his belt around his arm so that he could find a vein. "And how are you going to do that?" I could see he wasn't remotely interested in what I was saying. "Little by little," I said, anyway. "I'm going to stop shooting. I'm going to smoke just 1 bag a day, the way we used to. Then 1 bag every 2 days, and so on, until I stop completely. Well, go ahead and try, he said. Who's stopping you? I didn't blame him for not believing me. It wasn't the first time I'd said something similar. I probably didn't even believe it myself. Greg leaned back against the pillow and slid the needle into his forearm. In the same second, his body jerked convulsively, as if he had received an electric shock. I watched, horrified, as his body continued to jerk up and down on the bed, his arms and legs rising and falling in a crazy, rhythmless way, like a demented puppet's. He was making choking sounds, like a man being strangled. White foam was coming from his mouth. Then, suddenly, he was completely silent, completely still. So silent and so still that I knew he must be dead. I was in shock, I guess, because I didn't react immediately. It was about half an hour later that I called my mother at her office and told her where I was and to come quickly and how sorry I was. How sorry. Later still, I heard a policeman talking to my mother in the corridor. He was saying, "The thing is, you see, half the time these junkies don't know what they're buying. The purity of street heroin varies from 20% to 90%. But do the junkies know how strong the stuff that they're shooting is? Of course not. They buy blind, which means that they can accidentally take 3 or 4 times as much as they're planning to. My guess is that that's what happened here." "An overdose?" my mother asked. "That's right. Happens all the time. Lucky thing your daughter didn't try any of that stuff." I was in rehab, a drug rehabilitation unit, for 2 years. Day and night I thought about heroin. They gave me methadone, but that didn't stop the longing, the craving, the need. For 2 years I went through 3 different kinds of hell, physical and mental and spiritual, fighting with that devil and 100 other devils every inch of the way. But in the end I came out. I came back. That was a long, long time ago. Nearly 20 years now. But that cop was right. I was lucky. Unbelievably lucky. Now I have a house, a car, a job, a different life entirely. I don't take anything for granted anymore. Do I still think about heroin? Yes, I do. Do I still want it? Yes, I do. Because it's true what they say. Once an addict, always an addict. But will I ever touch it again? Never, never, never. Not heroin or any other drug. Why? Because I never want to go back to that hell again, that hell of being a junkie. I'm married now and have kids of my own. I'm very upfront with them about drugs. I tell them the truth. I tell them drugs can kill, drugs do kill, drugs will kill. I tell them, but before they kill you, drugs will steal your soul. I only pray that they'll believe me.